Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. Got a really interesting guest today with Mason Marangella. He is the owner and founder of Vertex Effects, which I'm sure you all know of if you play guitar. A little bit of background on Mason. In 2007, he graduated from UC Berkeley with a degree in sociology. He established Vertex in 2009 as a custom pedal board and a rig building company, just as a side hustle up until that time. And actually, until 2011, he was a full-time elementary school teacher. And I bet you probably have as many stories about that as you do about putting your pedal company together. In 2011, Vertex became a full-on corporation, and Mason transitioned to working on Vertex full-time. 2012, he started releasing pedals, working with major artists like Robin Ford, Michael Landau, Josh Smith, Matt Schofield, John Schofield, Scott Henderson, Michael Thompson, Steve Lukather, just a few of the many. And he started making signature products for a lot of these artists, as well as building their rigs. 2014, he released his first original design, the Vertex Boost. 2016, the second product came out, the Dynamic Distortion. And this year, 2017, he released the Steel String Clean Drive and the Battery Power Supply. They still have the T-Drive and the Ultraphonics Overdrive planned before the end of the year. You're probably listening to this in end of year or 2018, so that should be out by this time. And this is pretty cool about Vertex. They have access to some of the most rare amps in the world, from Dumbles to Trainwrecks to old Jose modded Marshalls. And the thing is, several of their clients are huge collectors. They all live within a 100-mile radius, and they basically get to check out the sounds of these amps and then make some accurate pedal versions of some really iconic amps. And they have more coming out with the Dumble ODS pedal and the Ultraphonics Overdrive coming this winter and several others. So that being said, Mason, man, thanks so much for coming on the show. Appreciate your time, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So let's tell us this. How did you go from being a school teacher to getting involved in pedals and modding gear, to not usually congruent with those two?
Right. Well, the school teacher thing was sort of just a necessity of when I was graduating from school in 2007. It was a pretty tough year for college students to be getting out of college and not really having any career prospects available to them. And I wasn't really sure whether, you know, I wanted to, you know, what capacity I wanted to be working in the music industry in, but I just knew that I couldn't support myself at that point doing any sort of like mods and repairs and pedal building. And so, you know, I wanted, you know, the luxury of health insurance, and I kind of just saw where there were opportunities for me to get a job immediately out of school. And my wife, who was my girlfriend then, she was in this program called Teach for America, which was, you know, responsible for taking Ivy League graduates and, you know, other college graduates and placing them into low income schools. It just so happened that the principal of the school that she was placed in knew of several other opportunities in you know, low income areas in the city of Oakland, where there were teaching opportunities available. So I was just able to get in there, and I started teaching. I really actually loved it. I never, you know, I didn't stop teaching because I like hated that job. It was the most awesome job in the world, I thought. Like, if you just wanted to be able to like be around kids, and you know, I'm kind of a showman, and I just had a captive audience all day long, and it was a really awesome job. But as Vertex started to develop, I couldn't be a great teacher and run a quality business at the same time. So I kind of chose where I had kind of created the thing myself. So decided to transition to Vertex. But yeah, that's kind of the story of how I got into teaching.
Were you? You said you wanted to do something in music. Were you a guitar player? Were you in bands, or what? What was your deal musically?
Yeah, so throughout college, I was always in bands, and you know, I was like, I basically made most of like my college living like buying, selling, and like repairing and reselling stuff on Craigslist. So I had this technique where I would buy like 60s and 70s like twin reverbs, and I would like pull the tubes out of them because they had all these like NOS tubes in a lot of cases, or I would like find like the free church organs for sale, or that were just being given away on Craigslist, and I would harvest like all the tubes out of them, and then I would load vintage-ish amps, like late, maybe drip edge, like Twin Reverbs or Princetons or Deluxes, because those were fairly inexpensive in the mid-2000s. I'd retube them with all NOS stuff, and I would basically restore them as close as possible to the originals, and then I would resell them, you know, at a $200-$400 profit sometimes. And because I knew how to repair stuff, you know, sort of like elementary, like black bass fenders are pretty simple for most people that know like a thing or two about amps. So I kind of focused more on those. And then, I also got into building guitars a little bit toward the last 2 years. So I didn't really know what capacity I wanted to be in the music industry. I just knew that I really liked to be creative in that way. I loved like vintage guitars and vintage amps. I knew a little bit about how to repair them, but I didn't really like have a finite job prospect in any of those avenues.
When you say NOS, you mean new old stock?
Yeah, so like original, like, you know, RCA tubes and, you know, stuff that was, you know, or probably original in most cases to what those amps would have come with. And so for some of these guys selling stuff, they never had to change the tubes because those NOS tubes just like lasted forever, you know.
Wow. That's pretty cool that you you went to school at Berkeley and you played music. That's like a very, like, everybody's dream. Like, I want to go to school at Berkeley and play music. That's kind of cool.
Right. Well, I guess it's the wrong Berkeley if you want to be a musician, right?
Yeah.
Like, Berkeley, they always assume it's like Boston Berkeley. Yeah.
UC Berkeley. But UC, I'm going to imagine that was a pretty laid back place to go to school.
It was cool. I didn't go there all 4 years, so I was at a community college first, which is actually where I learned how to do a lot of the analog design and engineering and stuff like that. Because once I got to Berkeley, there wasn't really much of that going on, and I thought that that's what was going to be going on, you know, just kind of foolishly, like not having really researched that. So when I had transferred there, I was expecting that I would be an electronic engineer. But what I found is that it really wasn't the type of like stuff that I wanted to be doing. Nobody who was, you know, at that university was really doing anything along the lines of analog technology, because it's a research university and all that stuff had already been done, you know, so they were trying to move on to like what was cutting edge. So I remember just going to the counselor and saying, what do I have the most credits for that I can graduate with the fastest? And she said, sociology. I was like, done.
So what gave you the leap of faith to transition to Vertex full time in 2011?
As like unromantic as it sounds, it was strictly financial. And I remember like at the point where I was sort of making more money doing Vertex than I did as like a teacher. And by that time I was married. And so I like had the kind of the comfort of still being able to get, you know, health insurance through my wife and just sort of like basic things that, you know, I was sort of took for granted, taken care of. It kind of gave me the ability. I think I was by that time, you know, it was maybe 25, 26. And I was kind of like, well, if this thing like doesn't work out, you know, I can always go and be a teacher again. Like, you know, and that'll be there for me. I had a credential and all that stuff. And so I thought it was, you know, not really a lot of risk. We didn't have any kids or anything like that. And I didn't really have any responsibility, you know, outside of just my wife and I. So that's kind of why I decided to do that. And, you know, it just ended up becoming bigger from that point when I could dedicate, you know, full weeks of work, to that exclusively.
So let's talk about how it get bigger. How did, you know, you're a new business and you're hooking up with guys like Robin Ford and Michael Landau. How did that, like, they didn't just come in and, you know.
Yeah. And in fact, those guys, I was starting to work with them when I was in my very last year of teaching. So I remember that kind of being sort of like the tipping point of like how overwhelming it was. Like the first, to answer your question about how I got hooked up with those guys, I got hooked up with Josh Smith first. And I was – my in-laws live in Los Angeles, really close to the baked potato. And
what is that?
What's that?
What's the baked potato?
Baked potato is sort of this iconic venue that all of the LA players or anybody who's in town and who's kind of like a guitar player is going to play.
Okay.
So, you know, that's where you'll see guys like Larry Carlton and Steve Lukather and Michael Landau and, you know, just any LA-based guitar player worth his salt is playing there. Not every day, but you know, they're definitely going to play there, and it's sort of like an LA institution. Mm. So every holiday for Thanksgiving, we had always gone out to LA. And I remember that I had seen that Josh Smith was on the marquee of the Baked Potato when we were driving in on the 101 for that night. And I was like, oh man, like I really like that guy's playing, because I had seen him like on these old exotic pedal videos that they had that were like, you know, now when I look at them, they're like super funky. It's like reality web video. And it had kind of like that zooming in and out, like really fast thing that like, you know, like the 90s and 2000s sort of like, you know, marketing videos had.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was like, oh man, I want to go to this. So I drove over there after we sort of unloaded our stuff, and it was like way early. I think that the gig started like at 9. I was there like 7 because I didn't really know the protocol of like how you get your tickets and stuff like that. And I just saw Josh Smith on the sidewalk, just like, you know, hanging out. And I just approached him and I said, hey, my name is Mason. I have this company called Vertex and I build like custom rigs. And I sort of just kind of explained to him what I was doing. He was like, oh man, like that sounds so cool. Like, yeah, like I totally would be interested in having you do some stuff. And so, you know, we exchanged information and we kept in touch. And within a few months, I built him this really cool like board. You know, they kind of had all the, you know, mid-2000, you know, pedal of the month sort of stuff on it. And and Josh was like super supportive of like, you know, putting the word out. And, you know, he was a friend of Michael Landau's. But, you know, I hadn't worked with him, you know, before that time. So he kind of had put my name in a few people's ear and ended up doing a rig for his friend named Kirk Fletcher, who's also just an amazing guitar player and just like kills at the blues and really, really amazing. And I, you know, just kind of stayed in touch with those guys over a few months. They had said, hey, you know, Mike Landau's going to be playing up in your area coming soon. Like you should, you know, go to that show at least. And, you know, we'll let him know that you're coming and maybe he'll have some time to like hang out. And so I remember at that point, like Mike Landau has been pretty famous for using this pedal called an Arion Chorus. And it's this sort of funky Bucket Brigade analog chorus that comes in this cheap plastic enclosure, but they just sound really great. And I had done this mod to one that I thought would be like right up his alley. And so I remember I brought one with me to the show and I was having dinner beforehand with my parents, in fact, who were like living kind of in proximity to where that gig was. And he just happened to be having dinner with his wife at the same restaurant before the show.
Oh, so like, wow, that's the universe. That's serendipity.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember I had my mom keep the pedal in her purse because I was like, man, I don't want this to get stolen. I don't want any chance of anything going wrong, like when we're leaving it, you know, because I want to really give him this pedal. And so he was like sitting in the booth right across from us. And so like, you know,
wow, that is like wild.
So I was sort of like watching them to see when they like maybe weren't, you know,
you're in the stalking him in between the salad and the main entree,
right? And I just like walked over there and I said, hey, I'm this friend of like Josh and Kirk's, and you know, they mentioned that they would, you know, say I was coming. He's like, oh yeah, yeah, they told me all about you. And I was like, well, I got this pedal that I think you're really gonna like, and you know, like just check it out. And he's like, yeah. He's like, man, he's like, I'll take it. But he's like, I can't make any promises. And, you know, if I like it, I'll contact you. And I was like, cool. You know, like I gave it to him and, you know, went to the gig and it was amazing. And maybe like 2 weeks later, he emailed me and he's like, yeah, he's like, I love this pedal. He's like, can you do it to these four other Arion choruses that I have? I want them to sound like this. So he sent me, you know, a bunch of choruses. I modded them up, sent them back.
What was the, you know, without like spilling your trade secrets, what, sure, like sonically, what did you do to make it different?
Well, so like he really liked how I was adding the second voicing to the chorus. And that wasn't something that was like unique to me. Like Exotic actually had a mod where they would put like a vibrato voicing, which really was just taking the chorus speed and allowing it to go faster with a certain setting by using like this toggle switch that's on the pedal. And they basically took that and made it so that instead of being a mono stereo toggle switch, that it was then a chorus like speed one and chorus speed two. So it basically gave you more depth and faster rates available. So it kind of got this vibrato type tone. So what I was doing was trying to not only do that, but take the newer version of the Arion and make it more like the original, which had, you know, significant differences. And ultimately, what Mike Landau wanted me to do after I'd modded these several ones for him is make them all sound like this one that he had that was sort of like the iconic one that he'd always used, which sounded a little bit different than all the other ones. And ultimately, that became a signature pedal where I replicated the chorus side of his pedal, the one that he thought sounded the best, and then put my vibrato channel as the second channel of that chorus. And I made it all stereo. And up to that time, I think the only ones that had mods, they were all mono. So like when they did the mod, they had to convert it to mono. They couldn't leave it stereo. So that was,
you truly had a unique like selling proposition with this thing. It was literally unique in the marketplace, which is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, it was as unique as you could make a mod, I suppose. But I just remember it was like such a nightmare to make that thing because we were, you know, I learned that you're so reliant upon the quality of the product that you get from the factory. And so I was ordering Arion SCHZs, which was like the sort of the reissue version, if you will, of the original one, which was called an SCH1. Mm-hmm. And when we would get them to our manufacturing facility, like 50% of them would not work, like just out of the box.
What do you mean they would? It just like didn't
like,
work?
They just like they were made in Sri Lanka, and they were just like everything was plastic, which was like we knew that because that's always the way that it's been. But they were very unreliable, and so a lot of times, you know, one of the stipulations in us working together with Michael Landau is he really wanted to maintain sort of the look and feel of the original as much as possible. Mm. And you know, because I had suggested like this might be better if we just did it as its own product because we wouldn't be dependent on having to create a working model just to mod
out of a 50% failure rate product.
Yeah, that was a little exaggerated, but I would say at least 30% were really serious, not even functional, like didn't even work out of the box.
Wow, it's hard to believe that somebody's selling something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, it was like, you know, I think the cost to me was, you know, maybe $40 or something like that. And then maybe the consumer price was a little higher than that. So, you know, I mean, you get what you pay for. But sure. Yeah, doing the mods to those, it was like a much bigger undertaking than I expected. Just because of all the time to sort of like get them, you know, up to par where they could even be moddable. Still, I mean, it was a great sounding pedal. And now they're sort of like, they have like this cult following. Like I see them on Reverb sometimes, like getting like $300 or $400. And I think originally I was selling them for like $200.
Oh wow!
So now you can find one. They're like super expensive relative to what they were when they were being sold.
Let me ask you a question. When you were at that restaurant and you hooked up with Josh, and you guys exchanged numbers,
right?
When you walked out of there, man, like how good did you feel? Like.
Oh, I mean, it felt great because, you know, I'd recognized him, you know, as being sort of one of the sort of, you know, pillars of like young LA guitar players at that time. And I didn't really have anybody of note who I could reference as like a user of our products. Mm. And it just so happened, too, he's a really, really kind man, and you know, he had no agenda really other than to be helpful to me, and so it was very fortuitous that it wasn't you know, like I wasn't working with anybody that didn't have anything except the intention to be you know, help promote my company. And he really did. I mean, he was the one who got me in touch with Michael Landau, who begot all these other really, really incredible artists.
Are you still in touch with Josh? Or
I am not to the extent that I was back then. And, you know, Josh has, you know, moved on to some pretty incredible things, and he's, you know, working with other people to make his rigs. I don't really do that in that capacity anymore either. Sure. So I think it's probably a good thing for him.
Yeah.
You know, I always hold him in high esteem and certainly credit him with all of the accolades, you know, of sort of creating all the growth and kind of being really instrumental in kind of helping me develop Vertex into the company that it is.
He cracked the door open for you, basically.
He did. With professional guitar players, absolutely no doubt about that.
That's really cool. It's good to have a story like that.
Yeah.
In your bio, it said, in 2014, I released my first original design, the Vertex Boost. So I had two questions there. Number one, how is the Boost different from other – I'm assuming it's an overdrive pedal.
It's actually a clean Boost. So it's been less sexy than that.
So how is that different from other similar clean boost pedals? And the second question was, what kind of pedals were you selling before that? Was it all just mods?
Okay. So as far as the boost question, the concept of the Vertex Boost was sort of birthed with Michael Landau, who by that point was used a bunch of our modded pedals. We had a signature mod, modded Chorus, and he was expressing to me about this desire that he had to sort of remove the most critical tone sucking element that was always necessary in his rigs, that he could never quite mitigate the tonal degradation fully of, which is the volume pedal. And as a session guitar player, that's sort of a necessary evil that they all have to be able to have on their rigs to sort of control dynamics and things like that. And so he had said, you know, is there a way that we could create a product that would allow me to control the volume without having to, you know, completely destroy the tone of my rig, and also allow me to be able to boost my volume of my rig without changing the character of the other products that are before the boost?
Okay.
You know, because the product that he had been using in the past to sort of do this in the studio added a coloration to whatever the pre-existing sound was. So it was like he had everything dialed in with its overdrives. He'd go to hit the boost, and then it would either add a compression or change the EQ in such a way that wasn't natural to what the amp would produce if it were just turned up. So again, being able to mitigate any volume pedal tone suck, that was goal one. Goal two was, how do we boost the sound without changing the character of anything that's associated or being played in conjunction with the boost? And so I started developing what was the Vertex Boost at that time, to be able to meet the needs of what he had requested. And the first kind of attempt at doing that was actually taking a pedal that he already had, which was made by a company called Vemoram, called a Janray. And it was a really primitive attempt at doing that, where essentially what we did is you could plug in an expression pedal into this pedal, and it would bypass the volume pot on this distortion overdrive pedal, and it would move it to an expression pedal. So instead of like turning the volume pot manually, you would be able to do it with your foot to control the volume. But the downside of that is that you always had to have the pedal on in order to be able to do that. So you already had like a pre-existing color of whatever the, you know, this overdrive pedal would do.
Sure.
So we really then just had to build a whole new pedal, something that was really linear. And by that I mean like it just didn't have a color. It was literally just like a flat EQ that was just adding clean volume and doing nothing else. And that's, you know, ultimately what became the Vertex Boost. It was like something that he could turn the volume all the way down on it, you know, where it was unity gain, turn the thing on and off with the volume pedal plugged in, and would hear no difference between volume pedal on and, you know, or volume pedal engaged and volume pedal bypassed. Sure. So it was like that transparent, where the boost was not coloring anything. And when he turned it up, it had the same effect as if he just like walked over to his amp and turned it up, but he could control it remotely using a volume pedal or an expression pedal that would connect into the Vertex Boost. So that was something that was unlike anything else at that time.
Gotcha. Just explaining that is complicated. I'm trying to get my head around how you actually managed to like engineer this from a science standpoint. I mean, don't tell me, because it's like way above my freaking comprehension. Sure. But I'm like, wow. Yeah. Before that, you were just doing mods. I say just, but you were primarily doing mods. You're like a custom mod shop, basically.
Sort of. I would say that we were sort of like half and half. Like we were half building rigs and modifying pedals that would kind of make them better work synergistically with the rest of the rig. So I was like, you know, true bypass and maybe doing some like slight tone shaping mods, stuff like that. And then the other side was, you know, doing these modded volume pedals, doing modded choruses. We also had this other product that we did very few of called made by Carl Martin. It was called a Plexitone. And we would add like a 3-band EQ, like treble, middle, bass, like a Marshall style EQ into this Plexitone. And then we were also doing wah mods, which is eventually what led into this product called the Access Wah, which is something that, you know, was definitely, you know, the gigantic black eye on the company that kind of all culminated around 2014, and about September or so of 2014. which kind of came out of me doing wah mods to various wah pedals for Michael Landau that sort of kind of like spun off into this particular product, which definitely became very controversial, mostly around the way that it was marketed and sold to people, that was kind of not done with the utmost honesty and integrity as, you know, all the other products where we'd say, like, this is clearly a mod, this is what we used, and there was clear descriptions around what that was, whereas on this product there wasn't that, and so customers that bought that thinking it was one thing ultimately came to find out that it wasn't what it was marketed to them as.
So you caught a lot of crap for that, and I know you had a sort of like coming to Jesus meeting with yourself, and like I know you had to go through a like everybody does with something in life at some point in time, you fixed it or you did the best you can to rectify it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at that point in time though, you were really a service business, you can scale, you really couldn't scale what you were doing. It was pretty labor intensive.
Yeah, it was definitely a tough thing, and that's kind of why we started to make the pivot to pedals, because a lot of the knowledge over time that I sort of, you know, came to learn about like wiring the rigs and the best ways to do it, and what was sort of yielding consistent results. You know, I mean, obviously there's things that you can teach to other people to sort of be able to replicate that, but I just didn't find that it was as easy and repeatable and as like long-term, didn't have as much long-term viability or sustainability for me as a business. And so I started to sort of maybe only maintain pre-existing clients and then pivot over to doing pedals. And the goal was always, even pre-existing the wah scandal, was always to just move everything over to pedals and kind of let the rig stuff sort of fall off, and kind of like treat that as like the sort of the learning ground that sort of helped us develop the products that we have now. And then kind of have that just be part of the legacy of the company.
Sure. Hey, I didn't mean before when you were talking about the wah scandal, did you want to like expand on anything there? I mean, I don't feel compelled to address anything because it's nothing to do with me, but if you wanted to say anything more, you know, to people that are brand new and listening to you or something, please feel free.
Sure. So for people that are not familiar with it, we had a product called the Axis Wah, and we had a few different versions of it. One was just standard. The other one was NOS. And NOS, as we spoke about a little earlier, was new old stock. And essentially, with the new old stock version, I would change the potentiometer to one that was more typical of what would be seen in the early like Vox Clyde McCoy, that it was an S-taper 100K pot, and the other one just had the stock pot that would come in the BBE wah, which is the wah that I was buying directly from BBE and then rebranding with Vertex aesthetics, Vertex logos, you know, changing kind of some of the less expensive parts on it to kind of give it a boutique aesthetic and vibe, and kind of make sure that the quality was sort of in keeping with the branding that we had. And ultimately, because there was no declaration of what the product was and where we were getting it from, that this became very publicly recognized. And in the face of that, my instinct as the leader of the company was to try to sidestep it and hope that it would go away. And ultimately, that ended up culminating in, you know, me doing everything that I could to sort of try to avoid scandal, which had me kind of dig myself deeper by lying about where we were getting products from, what my background was, you know, and my qualifications and things like that, anything to do to sort of justify the existence of this product as being okay, and that it was really, you know, something that was, you know, made in the USA, et cetera, none of which were true. And ultimately in September, this is sort of started maybe around July 2014, by September, there was, you know, just overwhelming, surmounting evidence. You know, all of our artists, you know, from Michael Landau to Steve Lukather, they were kind of like, hey, you know, like, this is clear. We can't be associated with you anymore because, you know, our reputations are at stake. And, you know, it kind of forced me to have to be like, man, like, is this the, is this the hill that I want to die on? Is this like being a liar about this you know, this product that, you know, was not sold with integrity? And so I really had to face the music on that one, and wrote a, you know, a very long piece, which was sort of just naming all the things that were, you know, true about the product and about myself, and then just giving people the option to be able to return the product for a refund. And it ended up, you know, taking, you know, almost a year and a half to be able to make everybody whole again. But everybody who owned that product was either refunded or exchanged for another product, or given whatever form of kind of restitution that they requested was honored. And that went, you know, on the customer level and the dealer level and the distributor level, everybody was taken care of. And, you know, that was certainly a really, really painful time, but I think it was also, you know, really disheartening for customers who felt like they bought something in good conscience and that their confidence was betrayed. And, you know, my goal was, whether Vertex ever stayed in business or not, that I would be able to sort of exit the industry and say that I did everything possible to restore my integrity with the customers and the dealerships that, you know, were willing to take me on. And fortunately, for the people that owned the product, they were really pretty amazingly cool about, you know, being understanding and, you know, in some cases waiting a year and a half to get their full refund, in many cases. And a lot of those people are still our customers today. And with exception to two dealers, every single dealer and distributor has come back on board that was pre-existing that time. And I don't think that would have been possible unless there was the transparency around what we were doing and that we, you know, in fact provide, you know, refunds to everybody. And I think that went a long way in sort of restoring it. And for some people, that will never be enough. And, you know, there's the belief that maybe I shouldn't be around anymore or be allowed to operate in the marketplace. But I was really just a, you know, this is something I love doing. It would just be like saying, you know, you can't breathe anymore. You know, this is sort of, you know, what my passion and life's purpose is really around, the creation of musical products. And I figured that the marketplace would tell me whether I had a place here or not. And fortunately, you know, people are supporting our business, and we're more successful now than we ever were prior to that.
So here's my thoughts on this. I have never met you before. We spoke briefly on a call. And this is what I would say as an objective person. You're 32 years old. When that happened, you were 29, right?
Let's see, 2014, yeah.
Right, okay. I'm a father of three kids. One of them's 27, one of them's 25, and one of them's 17. And I think looking at this from that standpoint, as a 29-year-old person, getting involved in something that you didn't know how to handle, you probably didn't have anybody to go to for guidance at the time to ask what to do. As a human being, forget about as a business person, I don't think the mistake you made is unreasonable for a 29-year-old guy owning a business. All of a sudden shit blows up and like he finds himself. I think if I'm honest, I could see my son maybe doing the same exact thing, trying to, you know, ignore it. Because when you're younger, I think, depending upon your personality, your tendency may be to ignore stuff and it'll go away. Or, you know, you don't have the coping skills, frankly, at the time at certain ages to do, you know, as you get older, you have more coping skills to do more things. So I don't think, it's just my opinion. I don't know you. I have no vested interest either way, but I commend you for doing what you did the best you can to rectify this situation. And I think sometimes it's very easy to skewer somebody, but owning a business is very difficult. And I have owned many in the last 20 years, and I've done a lot of different projects. And the older I get, the smarter I get. With not just owning a business, with being a dad, being a husband, you know, just being a human being. So I think that you probably learned a lesson publicly that would have been better off to learn privately, but it's probably a lesson that you needed to learn one way or another, so that moving forward, you have now the coping skills that if something happens, probably in any aspects of your life, your response will be not to duck it or to try to twist it, but to own it and just fix it like you did, because it's a lot easier, a lot less stress.
Absolutely.
You know,
That's the big takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, that being said, there's always people that are going to bust your balls no matter what you do and who you are. You can't make everybody happy 24 hours a day. I've been with my wife 25 years. I love her dearly more than any human being on earth could love another human being. I can't make her happy 24 hours a day, and she can't make me happy. Most of the time, yeah, but it's not possible. So there's always going to be someone that's going to be like, you know, this guy's a thief, this guy's an asshole. But it's really easy. All I'm saying is I think if people put themselves in your shoes, I don't think what you did was it. I didn't hear once anything in there that was like ethically corrupt. What I heard you say was I didn't know how to deal with this. And so I lied about it. I didn't hear you say I wanted to fuck a bunch of people over and not have to give money back.
And that's sort of where the primary sort of positioning of the argument about whether I'm deserving of being a member of the musical industry manufacturing community is really on an ethical question. I think it seems to be, you know, when I see negative feedback at this point, it's more of a question of what my motivations were, and that it was somehow in order to swindle people out of their money. And really, I think more than anything, like upon a lot of reflection, it was really just about wanting to, you know, have a recognized and a popular brand. And, you know, we had created a product that was actually supposed to replace the wah, that kind of like had those elements plus a bunch of other wah circuits of different eras that were built inside of it. They were all switchable. And we kind of kept pushing it back because we're like, well, this wah is like, it's outselling all of our other products. And we never thought that this would be like a popular product, a $350 wah. Like, why would anybody, you know, really want this? We could never make enough of them. Everybody just wanted them because, you know, Pete Thorne demoed one and was using it on his pedal board. And, you know, of course he does amazing demos and is a fantastic player. And when he puts kind of his stamp of approval on something by, you know, using it on his own rig, it kind of like that, those videos took off, and just kind of like created this, I don't know, sort of, this frenzy of everybody just wanting to have that product. And, you know, I knew that like the other shoe was going to drop, and I just kind of just kept going with it. And it was like a really dumb decision to do that. And, you know, first of all, shouldn't have done it in the first place. But when it was obvious, it was definitely the time to like just name it and be like, yeah, this is what it is. And, you know, like, I'm glad people love it, but it's not, you know, a USA made product. It's coming from this other company. We're giving it this facelift and, you know, giving people all the information to make the choice on their own. And, you know, that was a really, really crucial learning experience that kind of has shaped the direction that the company has gone. You know, certainly, like, as you said, it would have been a much better lesson to learn privately. But, you know, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, there has to be a fire in order to really promote growth and change. And there was that.
Yeah, not sometimes, always. You don't learn when there's no learning when everything's perfect. Trust me.
Right.
You only learn when you know, the shit hits the fan. So,
right.
You know, look, man, it sounds like you did the right thing. Again, I don't know you. I have no vested interest. But just as a person talking to you, I mean, everybody does stuff. I mean, I was such an asshole when I was a kid, man. And I'm so ashamed of that. And like, I meet people now that I knew from when I was younger, and I'm almost embarrassed. And nobody like brings that up. They just figure, oh, I was a kid. And it kind of sounds like the same stuff. You know, everybody, I don't know. I don't know. If somebody doesn't like you or your products, they can buy it from somebody else. It's real simple.
Right.
You know? Anyway, man, well, thank you for sharing that story, man. That was
sure. I don't want to get too dark here.
What's that? No, I mean, there is no too dark. I mean, this is like, you know, life. If this is too dark for somebody, man, don't leave the house because it's fucking dangerous out there. If hearing your story about a mistake you made in business is too dark for someone, man, here's my advice: do not leave the house. But, you know, don't have a relationship. Don't engage with anybody. Don't get a job, because if you can't handle this story, my God, you gotta get some help, man, because life's gonna fucking swallow you whole. Anyway, that being said, thank you again.
Sure.
Besides that, what have been some of the bigger surprises about the business aspect of what you do that have been like, oh, wow, if any?
Business, like...
The nature of the marketplace, the nature of what people want. Like, has anything come out and surprised? Like, you made a comment. You said, man, I was shocked people would want a $350 pedal, and it went nuts. Have you had, besides this product, but have not necessarily the same situation, but has... I'm hiring employees is tougher than I thought, or, you know, maintaining a certain, what about the business has been either positively surprising or negatively surprising, just the industry, the business, so on and so forth?
I'd say the biggest surprise to me is because of the invention of the internet and social media, there is very seldom, I've found, or infrequently, a parallel between what looks visibly successful and what actually is producing profits. And I think we can see this pretty frequently in the pedal industry, where it seems to be really a revolving door of, like, you know, tons of new brands coming on board and then seem to exit just as quickly. I think that as you start to develop and grow quickly, which I certainly learned, that there's a high probability of sort of financial issues to occur, because you're either, you know, you're budgeting for maybe a more consistent or constant variable as far as, you know, income and expenditures, and then you grow really fast, and those models don't generally hold up the same way as you grow. And so a lot of smaller companies, they get big really fast. I think that it can almost be as destructive as, not being able to generate enough business. And I think we can see too, you know, when I go to trade shows and things like that, I look at companies that by all intents and purposes are much larger than many others that, you know, are there by social media followings and things like that. And they're kind of ghost towns. And so it makes me think that, you know, a lot of times what we see as customers is what looks like really pretty and polished and lots of interests. We see these companies disappear just as fast as they come in. And, there's an art to being able to create a great product, but also being able to have the insulation in your business to be able to kind of keep all those products afloat. Because every time you bring on a new product, it's like having another kid. You have to be able to budget for those things and market for those accordingly, and kind of adjust how you spend to, you know, reflect sort of what your product line looks like. And it's so complicated. Like, making pedals is like, you know, 10% of like what your daily,
challenges.
Yeah. What it looks like, you know, it's such a small part of the puzzle. And so people who ask about, you know, getting into this industry and stuff like that, it's almost like almost the auxiliary skills are almost, you know, more important than the making of the pedal part.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. People who don't run a business really sometimes aren't aware of all the challenges. I mean, like, you know, you've got to commit X amount of dollars to this thing, and if it doesn't sell, those dollars are committed. Now you got to pull dollars from somewhere else to bring on something else that might be selling. Right. And it's a tough thing. It's dicey, and it takes a long time. And you can have the best projections in the world. The bottom line is, if the marketplace feels otherwise, positively or negatively, it's out of your control. So yeah, okay, that is a good a big surprise. So let me ask you this. And you kind of answered it, and we don't have to specifically talk about the quote scandal, but if you can go back and give advice to your younger self on any aspect, what advice would you have given yourself? What advice would, you know, Mason Marangella of today give to Mason Marangella of 2011 when he first incorporated Vertex?
Yeah, I would say don't be in a hurry, you know, to grow so fast. I think when I was in my early 20s, I would say that having name recognition was very important to me. It was kind of like almost like the popularity of the brand was more important than the substance. And I think that that's reflected in sort of what happened with the WA. in that, you know, I was kind of willing to take some shortcuts to kind of reaching a level of brand recognition and success and having all the hip, cool guitar players using the products and things like that. And that was sort of a trade that I made, you know, morally to be able to sort of reach this next echelon. And there certainly is a tendency for brands to want to, you know, run before they can crawl. And that would be kind of the whole premise is like, learn how to become a good manager, like learn how to become a good boss and a good businessman.
Right.
That's really what I should have been spending my time on is, you know, figuring out how to run a company well and sort of all of the things that go into that instead of just trying to figure out how to grow it. Because, you know, I grew fast and you know, even you know, any sort of reputational or ethical things aside, you know, financially, that was going to be on a crash course because we were, you know, we were getting so many orders. We didn't know how to manage it really. And, you know, we were just lucky that that didn't just become, you know, another footnote on top of sort of the ethical things that happened with the WAW. You know, it was sort of like moving into that place where you know, we were going to have so many orders and having taken so much in deposits that we wouldn't have been able to deliver on all of those. And we see that's a really typical thing that a lot of companies get into. And I don't think it's because of any sort of deliberate, you know, scam to try to cheat people out of their money. It's that this stuff happens fast and a lot of these guys are terrible business managers and they have all this money and that they think is theirs to spend. And it's, you know, more than 50 or 60% of that is really just going to go right back into what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that would be my advice.
I think that, again, this comes down to everything I'm hearing you say. You were 26 years old when you first did this thing, man. And, you know, I think everything that you're saying is chalked up to just inexperience in running a business and being young. I don't, you know, and that's, you know, the only difference is, like I said, this was made public because of the internet or whatever. But, you know, anyway, that was a good answer to that question. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or would find a little odd.
Find odd. Probably the thing that I guess some people on some of the forums have like delved into this a little bit about me, but I used to do, or, you know, and still to a degree do competitive physique and bodybuilding.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah. So like I remember when the WAW scandal came out, like some guy like hacked into like a photo bucket account, like posting all these, and they're like, well, he really sucks at, you know, making WAW pedals, but you know, boy, is he in great shape, you know, like.
That's funny, man. So when's the last time you competed?
I haven't competed for 3 years. But I had been, you know, leading up to that, I had been, you know, doing all of the training and competitions and things like that. And I only did the natural bodybuilding competitions, which I say are more akin to like a traveling circus. Like they're don't have the same
quality. The key word is natural there. That's why.
Right. Yeah. So there's nobody that, like, there's not guys that are usually over 200 pounds. Cause just when you're, you know, when you're in single digit body fat, you just can't get that big.
Naturally. No.
So yeah, I do that.
You have a pro card or something?
No, I never got a pro. I think the best I ever placed was sixth, and I think you need to be one or two to get a pro card for natural. I never placed better than sixth when I was doing that, but it was certainly fun and made. You know, trying to just maintain like a healthy lifestyle, like having a little more goal oriented for me. It's good for me to have like a target to go after. So it just was a little bit more deliberate when I would go to the gym instead of just, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Throwing weights and not really having much behind it.
No, that's good to do that, man. I'm in pretty good shape. And like, it doesn't matter when you're your age, but as you get older, you're going to see your peers and you're going to be like, holy shit. And you'll be thankful that just aesthetically, but also your health, you'll have less health issues in all likelihood. Yeah.
Yeah. That was kind of it's a great place. It's like almost meditative, you know,
it's definitely clears your head, man. You said you're married. You have any kids?
No kids. No, not yet. My wife is, is a principal of an elementary school here in Oakland, and you know, I think she feels like she's got like, you know, 350 kids every day.
I was going to say that must be like birth control, being a principal of an elementary school.
I think it's definitely a place that we want to go. Although I don't know, it feels like now, I don't know, we were like the first people that we knew to ever get married, and it looks like we're going to be probably like the last to have children. But
it's all right, man. All in good time.
Yeah, that's right.
You have any hobbies or interests outside of music, and I guess in bodybuilding?
Hobbies that I have outside of that, I would say the main thing that occupies my time other than gym and Vertex and hanging with my wife is we have a 2-year-old Vizsla dog named Zeke, and we go on a lot of hikes. Oakland happens to be pretty replete with some pretty beautiful redwood forests. So, you know, we go on nice, hikes in the redwoods with him, and, you know, we're definitely, dog people over here. I usually have, you know, my dog and maybe one other dog cool. here at, you know, either at my house or at our shop every day. So
very cool. Hey, I'll tell you what, having had all of them, dogs are easier than kids. I will tell you that much.
I'll find out and we'll reconnect on that.
Two more questions, man. Toughest okay. decision, and maybe we covered this. Toughest decision you ever had to make, or I say hardest thing you ever had to do. I'm assuming that was one of the hardest things you had to do, but toughest decisions you ever had to make.
Yeah, in my business.
You tell me, business or personal, doesn't matter.
Yeah, I would say that would still probably be the same either way. Yeah, I would say the toughest decision was to be able to be completely open and honest about everything regarding, you know, my business and my qualifications and it was the most frightening thing I've ever done, and probably also on the flip side the most freeing thing, is just to be able to kind of have that all out there without any mystery and kind of writing this, I don't know, few thousand word you know, sort of essay essentially about kind of the facts around me, the business owner, and kind of the products that I had. And yeah, I would say that was by far, you know, the scariest thing I've ever done.
It sounds like it was kind of cathartic for you though, writing that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Extremely, extremely.
Last question, man. Who's had the biggest influence on you? Person who had the biggest influence on you?
Biggest influence. It's hard for me to choose one because I feel like these influences are sort of constantly showing up for me.
You don't have to choose one. If you got more than one, that's good.
I would say that my dad is definitely the biggest influence on me. As common of an answer as that seems to be to these sorts of questions, you know, my dad has a very principled and integrity driven lifestyle. And although I can't say that I've matched him even closely with, you know, how I've lived my life as much as I aspire to be like that, I still find, you know, myself, you know, making mistakes, and certainly will continue to. But I'm always a believer in having kind of higher goals than maybe even possible. And I feel like I get a lot further by pushing myself than just sort of setting a more attainable goal for myself. So I definitely feel like my dad is that person for me. I would also say like another person that really inspires me would be my good buddy Robin Ford, I would say. And he demonstrates a quality that I think is really hard for people to do, where he knew that you know, in the face of this access fall, we continue to kind of go back to this, in the face of knowing that was really wrong and being disappointed by a decision, he was sort of able to separate the personal side of it from sort of like what the right thing to do was. And he had written this really beautiful article, you know, for me, basically saying, listen, this guy screwed up really bad and it's going to impact a lot of people, but like, let's not forget that he's human and like these things are going to happen. And like, none of us are immune from this. And, you know, I stand behind my friend. And to me, like I don't know that I've ever felt that somebody went to bat for me so so eloquently and so selflessly. And I feel that that's sort of rare in amongst kind of entertainment professionals to sacrifice maybe some of their reputation or be willing to take a few bruises for somebody else. And Robin was just incredible in doing that and really had no expectation of me, you know, in terms of reciprocity. He just is like, this is what I feel, and I want to be able to communicate that to people. And whatever happens to me, you know, if people, you know, say that I'm, you know, I don't know, as corrupt as you or whatever possible thing they could think of, he was willing to do that in the face of no agreement from most of the public at that point. And so I really admire people who are willing to do the right thing, and it's difficult. And I would say the last person that that I can name that I'm really inspired by and you know, is just really kind of a mentor of mine is my wife. And you know, she is she's an incredibly strong person, and she has been an educator for over 10 years and has been a principal for two. And her approach to education and to people, it's like her passion for that matches my passion for pedals, except I feel like her dedication like makes maybe a much more impactful has a much more impactful social
impact. Yeah.
Than pedals. And so sometimes I feel like, man, like, you know, I came out with a new pedal, like, what is this, you know, how is this really helping the world? You know, I really like to try to keep that in mind. And, you know, as part of our company mission statement, like, we volunteer weekly at schools and put in time volunteering in music programs in local Oakland schools. And that's just part of our mission. And, you know, we get to kind of see, you know, the way that manifests itself in student learning and things like that. And so, you know, it's without my wife and sort of the being able to kind of see the way that you know, the outside of the business community, how a lot of things are done in the educational realm, it certainly is inspiring to me to see this sort of work that teachers and principals and educators are putting in every week. And we certainly want to be a part of that in any way that we can. And definitely try to volunteer and create, you know, learning and music at the very least with what we can do here at Vertex in our limited capacity.
Man, listen, I give you a lot of credit because I think you handled everything fine, to be honest with you. You're just a young guy that got in trouble, got in over his head, and you just made good. And I'm sorry that you had to go through all that stuff, but I'm glad you came out of it, you know, pretty together. So I really appreciate your time, and I'm thank you for coming on the show. How can people find you? Tell you know, what would you like to promote, or, you know, what should people know about Vertex that's going on right now?
Sure. So what people should know about is we have our probably one of the coolest pedals that we've ever done, which is called the Ultraphonics, and it's based on the Dumble Overdrive Special. We actually had three different Overdrive Specials to voice this thing with, which is pretty unique. We know of other companies that have used a single Overdrive Special to kind of voice a pedal, but there's so many different distinctions from Dumble to Dumble, and so we wanted to have as representative of a sample as possible. And so by having three, we could really kind of find what are the real commonalities and how can we translate that into a clean amp to really give the feel and texture and note bloom that's quintessentially Dumble. So that's what we've done with the Ultraphonics. And that's coming out right at NAMM, which is the last week of January.
Awesome.
And it's going to be, you know, I mean, people who play this thing are always trying to find a way to sneak it out of our shop. it's a really inspiring pedal, and if you're at all, you know, a fan of the Dumble sound, it really, really incorporates it amazingly well. And I think people are going to be incredibly happy with the results compared to other stuff that they may have used that are along those same lines. And so I would say Ultraphonics, check it out. It's on our website at vertexeffects.com.
Awesome. So, and everything that you do comes out of vertexeffects.com?
Everything that we do comes out of vertexeffects.com. And, yeah, we're on all the, you know, major social media networks from Instagram to Facebook, and there'll be plenty of demo videos on YouTube to view, so you can kind of see how it pairs with a variety of maybe playing styles and amplifiers and guitars and things like that. We try to do a really complete job of kind of giving people the picture through what, you know, gear they may have at home.
Awesome. Do you go to NAMM at both shows?
We generally are always at Winter, and I'm unsure yet of Summer NAMM in Nashville, although I really like Nashville, so I'll probably be there. So count on it now.
Hopefully I will meet you up there in person. I won't be at the Winter one, but I will be at the Summer one, man. So hopefully we'll get to connect in person.
That'd be great.
Listen, Mason, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the show. Thank you for being so candid and transparent. And, you know, I'm sorry you had to go through all this stuff, and I'm glad that you it sounds like you did all the right things. You know, you gave people their money back. I don't know what else you can do. You know, you're supposed to do lay on a cross because she screwed up. I don't know. I tend to be, as I've gotten older, more just forgiving and compassionate. Just life's a lot easier and less stressful, especially if you gave everybody their money back. And you probably didn't even ask for the pedals back.
It depended. If people wanted the full refund, then they would give us the pedal back. Some people like the product and they wanted to keep it, so we gave them the difference between like what the actual pedal what costs new and what they paid for it. So it was just dependent upon what, again, whatever the person asked for, we would honor.
Sounds like a pretty fair deal to me. Hey man, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Everybody, you're welcome, man. Anytime. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. And again, my hat's off to Mason Marangella for, you know, owning up some stuff that he did 3 years ago, which is about 100 years ago in today's warp speed of time. I'm glad no one's ever made me account for all the asshole moves I made when I was a kid. Anyway, thanks again. I appreciate you spending time with us, Mason. And I appreciate it. Everybody, everyone loves guitar. Sign up to get notified about future episodes along with some cool stuff for guitar players. Now, be nice, go play guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I am out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.